Welcome to this episode of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, February 15. This week, we dissected a review article published in the February issue of the journal Oncology titled Utility of the 21 Gene Recurrence Score in Node-Positive Breast Cancer. The piece highlights the existing literature regarding the prognostic and predictive capabilities of the 21 Gene Recurrence Score in this group of patients, focusing on current practice patterns and emerging applications from the surrounding literature. For our first interview of the episode, I spoke with two authors of the review piece, Dr. Allison Laws, an associate surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Dr. Philip Porvoo, a medical oncologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Laws and Porvoo provide valuable information on the process, focus, and main takeaways of this review. Dr. Laws, Dr. Porvoo, thank you so much for taking the time to jump on the podcast with me. I really appreciate it. I was hoping we could just, you know, start with some brief background on the research you did that published in the journal titled Utility of the 21 Gene Recurrence Score in Node-Positive Breast Cancer. Could you just give a brief background and expand on some of the significance for patients with node-positive breast cancer?
Yeah, so the 21 gene recurrence score, also known as the Oncotype DX, is a genomic assay that's performed on paraffin-embedded tumor tissue, and it measures the gene expression of 16 different cancer-related genes and 5 reference genes. And based on the levels of gene expression, there is an algorithm that produces a recurrence score, which is a number from 0 to 100. Where a higher score represents a higher risk of distant disease recurrence. The 21 gene recurrence score was initially developed and validated in node negative estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. And so there was a lot of work done when this assay was initially developed to sort of validate its prognostic ability, so its ability to sort of risk stratify patients in terms of likelihood of disease recurrence and survival. And then subsequently, it was shown to in fact have this predictive ability to be able to determine whether a patient will gain benefit from chemotherapy or not. With all of the work that was done, this has really had a very substantial impact on clinical practice in node negative patients, because that was the population where all of these efforts were initially applied. And we have seen, significant reductions in chemotherapy use in that population as a result. I think what we're now seeing is a somewhat similar story unfold in the node positive population, but because that was not the population where this test was initially developed and validated, it has taken us some time to sort of gain enough data to be able to make some of the similar conclusions and similar applications to the node positive population. And so that's the data that this review paper really focuses on, is sort of the development of series published really over the past decade that now allow us to be able to demonstrate the clinical utility of the recurrence score in node positive patients as well.
And so, again, looking at the piece, what were some of the key findings you had, just, I guess, generally stated, and what was the motivation behind pursuing this piece for you and your colleagues?
I think in terms of our motivation, the use of the recurrence score in the node-positive population has been a little bit more controversial, and it's been a little bit slower to adopt because of the reasons we previously talked about in terms of how this test was initially developed. Historically, node-positive patients are a population where chemotherapy is fairly routinely used. And when we're thinking about now de-escalating care, I think providers want to see a fairly high level of evidence supporting the safety of that type of approach. While there has been retrospective series out for some time now suggesting that perhaps the recurrence score can be used in that way in the node-positive population, It wasn't until these more recent years, and in fact, as recently as last month, December of 2020, where we had now sort of prospective clinical trials that have looked at this question that provide level one evidence for the use of the recurrence score in this population. And then sort of in parallel with those clinical trials emerging, we have seen more and more institutions now, you know, cautiously adopting the recurrence score in this population. And beginning to publish on their experiences using it. And so we felt that it was sort of the right time to reevaluate the literature and be able to provide a very, you know, comprehensive summary of the totality of evidence that really now can make a strong argument for the use of this tool in the node positive population.
And so you alluded to some of the research that you reviewed. I was hoping you could expand a little bit on some of the specifics of the research that you reviewed for the manuscript and what it revealed to you regarding the prognostic and predictive value of this recurrence score.
Sure. Well, I think overall, the data suggests that Oncotype is a very powerful tool for risk stratification and for chemotherapy decision-making. The prognostic value of Oncotype, meaning the likelihood that a patient would experience distant recurrence, really has been well-established among patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. And as Dr. Laws mentioned, this was initially evaluated among patients with node-negative breast cancer using retrospective analyses of prior prospective trials in which patients had been randomized to receive endocrine therapy alone versus endocrine therapy plus chemotherapy. And in 2004, data were published showing that recurrence score was independently associated with the risk of distant recurrence, and the rates corresponded to the different recurrence score groupings at the time, 0 to 17, 18 to 30, and 31 and above. Prior retrospective prospective analyses had also found that the test was predictive of chemotherapy benefit, indicating that patients with low risk scores did not benefit from chemotherapy, whereas patients with high risk scores did benefit from chemotherapy, and there was uncertainty regarding patients with intermediate recurrence scores, and that was really the basis for the prospective Taylor X trial, in which patients with scores of 11 to 25 were randomized to endocrine therapy alone versus endocrine therapy plus chemotherapy, and overall did not benefit from chemotherapy. This article, though, focuses on patients with node-positive, ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. And as Dr. Laws mentioned, we also discussed the eagerly anticipated results of the R-Xponder trial, which was presented at the 2020 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. In this trial, both premenopausal and postmenopausal women with 1 to 3 positive nodes and recurrence scores of 0 to 25 were randomized to receive endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy plus chemotherapy. And the primary objective was to determine the effect of chemotherapy on invasive disease-free survival. So here, including both distant recurrence and local recurrence events. Overall in the trial, chemotherapy benefit did not differ by the continuous recurrence score. And the authors assessed whether recurrence score was prognostic, and it was associated with invasive disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of 1.06 for every 1 unit increase in the recurrence score. So the authors concluded that postmenopausal women did not benefit from chemotherapy in any subgroup, and this really is important in practice changing because, as Dr. Laws had mentioned, this has been really controversial over the past decade. And so now we have high-quality data from a prospective trial showing that this test can be used to identify patients who don't benefit from chemotherapy and who can safely forego chemotherapy and the associated short and long-term side effects.
So Dr. Porwu really summarized the core kind of focus of the article, but within that piece, you both also and your colleagues kind of organized different factors of your research into kind of different paragraphs, including multi and single institution experiences, special populations, and other emerging applications. I was hoping to look at that specifically. What were some of the other emerging applications you wrote about where 21 gene recurrence score can apply, and what really stood out to you about these different aspects that compelled you to include them in your work?
Yeah, so I mean, I think all of this findings of how the recurrence score can be applied for adjuvant chemotherapy decision making comes sort of in the broader context of our increasing understanding of the importance of tumor biology on everything about breast cancer, how, you know, how it presents, how breast cancer responds to disease, how breast cancer responds to different treatments, and of course, long-term outcomes. And so I think when we start to see really nice evidence that the recurrence score can be so useful in this sphere of adjuvant chemotherapy decision-making, I think it really begs the question, well, are there other elements of breast cancer treatment where the recurrence score could also be applied and could be helpful in this kind of decision-making? Because this really is, you know, a tool that gives us a somewhat of a measure of tumor biology. And like I say, we know that that is more and more important the more that we learn about breast cancer. So I think that is somewhat what compels us and other researchers to be looking at these questions. And we sort of highlighted two areas where we see perhaps the most potential for the application of the recurrence score in other spheres of treatment. So the first was this idea that the recurrence score has also been shown to be able to prognosticate for local regional recurrence outcomes. And again, we're seeing sort of this same type of story unfold where there's now been two retrospective analyses of older large clinical trials using banked tissue. And so in both of these trials, the recurrence score has also been found to be independently prognostic for local regional recurrence. And specifically, if we think about the SWOG-8814 trial in the mastectomy subgroup, where this question, I think, becomes most interesting, because nodal status is a large driver of radiation therapy use in the post-mastectomy setting in sort of current day practice. And however, in the SWOG trial, they were able to show that the 10-year local regional recurrence rate in women with 1 to 3 positive nodes and a recurrence score of less than 18 was extremely low. It was 1.5% at 10 years, and that was in the absence of radiation therapy. And so it really sort of starts to beg the question, could the recurrence score be used to help identify a low-risk subset in whom we could potentially think about omitting radiation therapy? And again, I think especially in the post-mastectomy setting, this is an interesting question, because these patients often aren't necessarily getting radiation other than based on a positive nodal status. And radiation in the post-mastectomy setting has, you know, these additional morbidities, particularly in the context of breast reconstruction post after mastectomy. And so I think that this is one, you know, future direction that we hope to see, you know, more data develop in terms of, is this an area where we could use the recurrence score? The other sort of emerging application that we discussed was applying the recurrence score in the context of making decisions around neoadjuvant systemic therapy. And I think this is something, you know, as a surgeon, I am interested in, because this is an area where I get to have a little bit more involvement sometimes in how sequencing happens and thinking about the nuances here. You know, historically, as the management of the axilla in the node positive setting after neoadjuvant chemotherapy has evolved, we are sort of increasingly, I think, reflexively thinking about neoadjuvant chemotherapy for many node-positive patients. Because as a surgeon, it gives us the opportunity to think about downstaging the axilla, perhaps avoid an axillary lymph node dissection. But I think as we are learning that chemotherapy is not necessarily a recommended component of the systemic therapy treatment plan for all node positive patients anymore, we need to be very thoughtful as surgeons and as, you know, a group making a treatment plan that we're not over committing patients to chemotherapy that may not otherwise be recommended. And so this is an area where certainly at Dana-Farber, we are increasingly using an Oncotype to help give us a sense of, you know, is chemotherapy something that will be recommended for this patient or not? In the hormone receptor positive population, we have another form of neoadjuvant systemic therapy that we can think about, which is neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. Sometimes that can be used as an alternative to sort of accomplish our surgical outcomes. And so I think this is an evolving area, and I think especially with the upcoming publication of Responder, we'll be seeing more and more people thinking about using the recurrence score in the, you know, on the core biopsy tissue when we're thinking about a neoadjuvant therapy approach.
So then looking ahead, how do you see the field of breast cancer, and I guess specifically node positive breast cancer, evolving in the next 5 to 10 years, and taking into consideration everything that you've researched and we've discussed today, what does this manuscript do to really push the field forward in your opinion?
So, I mean, I think in my opinion, the sort of direction that we're seeing breast cancer management move is more towards, you know, increasingly personalized medicine. Mm-hmm. I think we want to treat patients with just the amount of therapy that they need. So we want to avoid overtreatment. We want to avoid undertreatment. I think we're at a place where we are seeing excellent long-term oncologic outcomes in the majority of breast cancer patients, including node-positive breast cancer patients, with our current treatment strategies. And I think what we now want to focus on is those nuances of sort of maintaining this excellent oncologic outcomes, but perhaps identifying areas where we can sort of dial back our therapy and you know, minimize our treatment-related morbidity while maintaining these excellent oncologic outcomes. And I think we feel that there's room for this, particularly in hormone receptor-positive disease, which again is really the population that we're talking about using the recurrence score in. I think, you know, every day in clinic, I'm seeing this play out, that no two patients are treated the same anymore. I mean, there's not, you can't look at an NCCN guideline and follow a pathway for a patient anymore. It's just, it's becoming increasingly nuanced and complex. And I think that's a good thing. I think we're able to, you know, we are moving towards this idea of personalized care and tailored treatment plans. I think from a local regional therapy perspective, you know, as a surgeon, I think, you know, this idea of applying the recurrence score to radiation therapy decision-making, I hope is something we'll see in the next 5 to 10 years. I think we're beginning to see the sort of foundational data emerge. And in fact, there are now a few clinical trials that are applying this concept. The one that we reference in this paper is the TAILOR-RT trial. So that will be the first clinical trial to randomize radiation therapy use in a node positive population with a low recurrence score. So a recurrence score of less than 18. So we're taking, you know, what we think is probably a low-risk group, and then for patients treated with breast-conserving surgery, they'll be randomized to either whole breast radiation alone versus whole breast radiation plus regional nodal radiation, and then for patients treated with mastectomy, the randomization is to no radiation versus post-mastectomy radiation, which would include the regional nodal basin. So I think it's very exciting to see these trials now accruing. And as we gain more data on this topic, I think that will continue to influence the way that node-positive breast cancer is treated, you know, hopefully in the near future.
And of course, I think that there are two areas that really need to be addressed in the setting of node-positive, ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer regarding the use of gene expression signatures and oncotype in particular over the next 5 years from this standpoint of systemic therapy. So the first is, how are we going to extrapolate the data from our responder to patients with four or more positive nodes? And two, how are we going to interpret the data with respect to premenopausal women? From what I understand, our responder was really the most definitive trial we'll get in this setting. And it will never have a trial for patients with four or more positive nodes. And given the absence of benefit among patients with 1 to 3 positive nodes, and the absence of data for patients with four or more positive nodes, I think it'll be really interesting to see how the breast oncology community, and specifically those who write guidelines, choose to move forward. Are we willing to extrapolate these data that we have to patients who have four or more positive nodes? And might this change a bit over time? I think the data we have from our responder with regard to premenopausal women are potentially problematic. While there was a benefit from chemotherapy seen, I think the data we have from other studies regarding the benefit of ovarian function suppression, including even brief episodes of amenorrhea induced by chemotherapy from NSABP B30, paired with the data from TAILOR-X, suggest that much, if not all, of the benefit is from endocrine therapy. And while we can't rule out that there is some direct benefit, I think there is some chance that with the available data we have, that many premenopausal women could be treated with chemotherapy to accomplish something that we can do with a GnRH agonist, which is, again, a safer and much better tolerated approach. And I worry about that. I hope that additional data from our responder regarding menstrual function are presented to help clarify this. And over the next years, I wonder if how we interpret this might evolve.
Great. Well, those are all the questions I had for you both. Dr. Laws, Dr. Porvoo, thank you so much for taking the time to share some insight on your research. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much for having us and for highlighting this work.
For this episode's response perspective, I spoke with Dr. Sarah Hurvitz, a professor of medicine at the UCLA Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center. Hurvitz detailed a number of studies analyzed by the review piece, putting into perspective the findings from various pieces of literature. She expanded on the team's work and looked towards the future for treating patients with node-positive breast cancer. Dr. Hurvitz, thank you so much for agreeing to jump on the podcast to speak with me a little bit about this piece. I just wanted to start off with a pretty general question regarding this type of article. So when you, the journal really gets a lot of these submissions of, you know, literature reviews, and I was hoping to get your perspective on the significance of that. What's the value of collecting and reviewing literature from this field specifically, you know, node-positive breast cancer, and how do these different results or findings from different pieces and different studies really help to inform our understanding of what we're looking at?
I think right now with the pace of the studies coming out, it's really important that we have access to review articles and manuscripts that help us understand all of the literature and all of the clinical trial results. There are so many studies being reported now relating to how to best manage early stage hormone receptor positive breast cancer, when we should escalate therapy, when we should de-escalate therapy, what tool we should use to determine whether a patient is most likely to benefit from chemotherapy or can be selected for a less aggressive approach. It seems like at every meeting, there are at least five clinical trials that are presented, either subset analyses of larger studies or studies whose primary aim is to address this question. And I think it can be overwhelming and daunting to put all of that information together and then apply it clinically without having somebody or without, you know, having a nice review that can explain the data, the nuances of the trials, and weaknesses and strengths of each of the studies and how to apply it and what data has not been presented yet and what questions have not been addressed yet. So I think at least for practicing oncologists, especially general medical oncologists who may be treating a variety of tumor histologies, it's so helpful to have an article pull it all together and provide this information so that when you're sitting down with a patient, you have one source to go to rather than pulling 10 or 12 different articles and trying to figure those nuances out on your own, which is a very time-consuming task to do.
And so with this review article specifically, you know, they talk about a number of different trials and they pull information and data from a number of different trials. And in particular, it's great because you are familiar with the R-Xponder trial, but they also include data from the SWOG-8814 trial and ADAPT trials. I was hoping to get kind of your perspective on whether it be just that R-Xponder trial or a number of them in general, of some of the main takeaways you saw from that data and things that really stood out to you.
The R-Xponder study was quite well done because it was a prospective randomized study that enrolled patients with 1 to 3 positive nodes. And it was relatively simple study design to follow because it really addressed in a randomized way, you know, chemotherapy plus endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy alone. and looked at the oncotype recurrence score and whether or not you could select a group of patients who don't require chemotherapy in spite of having positive lymph nodes. I think it was fairly easy to interpret and understand overall. The one thing that was a little tricky with those data was the fact that premenopausal women appeared to benefit from chemo regardless of the recurrence score, where postmenopausal women appeared to not require chemo regardless of recurrence score. Of course, all patients in the study had to have a recurrence score, you know, less than 26. So it wasn't high risk patients, but patients with an intermediate or low recurrence score who were eligible to go on this trial. The ADAPT study was interesting because it utilized this sort of pre-surgical biopsy to evaluate changes in Ki-67 and see if you could use that as a surrogate to select patients who are lower risk and may not need chemotherapy. I think the practical sort of integration of that approach in one's clinical practice may be a little bit more challenging. Checking oncotype in patients and using Ki-67 in that setting may be a little bit more challenging because usually we're treating patients not in the neoadjuvant setting with these agents, but it's intriguing. It was elegantly designed clinical trial, and I do think it provides us information. So, you know, the review article is able to kind of provide data from each of these studies and help us sort through the differences in these clinical trials and how we might, you know, utilize these in our own clinical practice.
So the researchers mention kind of in passing this idea that this is a prognostic and predictive value for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer or HER2 negative breast cancer. So how can that data, along with the data from the trials, really help to inform the potential findings regarding the value of it for node positive breast cancer?
So it's important to pull apart prognostic tools versus predictive tools. And I think we've seen pretty solid evidence that the Oncotype recurrence score can be used as both a prognostic and predictive tool. It not only tells us, you know, which patients are at higher risk of having a distant relapse, but also given the prospective design of studies like TAILOR-X and RxPONDER, has been able to show us that it's predictive for benefit with chemotherapy. And I think that's really important. The use of this tool should be restricted to patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative breast cancer. That's very clear. That's where all the data is. We now have pretty good evidence that it can be used in patients with 1 to 3 positive nodes. One of the things that one of the weaknesses of RxPONDER is the relatively small proportion of women who had 3 nodes involved. So I think the strongest evidence is its predictive ability in patients with 1 to 2 positive nodes. I think that the data are wonderful that we've seen thus far. However, there still are some unanswered questions left with that study in particular. For example, the benefit with chemotherapy did seem to be restricted to women who were premenopausal. And the question is begged, you know, if we used ovarian suppression plus endocrine therapy, would that be just as good as chemotherapy plus endocrine therapy? In other words, is chemo adding anything in a patient who undergoes ovarian suppression with an LHRH analog, for example? So those are the types of unanswered questions that we still need to address in our clinical practice.
And so going off of that a little bit, you know, what potential developments or future research avenues of research really exist as a result of this work? And what does this review article do to really push the field forward?
I think this review article addresses the most important trials that have been conducted now in helping us gauge where to utilize these tools in early stage hormone receptor positive breast cancer with limited nodal involvement. There are areas that do need to be better evaluated. As I mentioned, patients who are premenopausal and whether or not chemotherapy adds anything to endocrine therapy plus ovarian suppression, that would require a large randomized clinical trial. I don't know if it will ever be done, but hopefully more work will go into evaluating that. I think it would be nice if we could also see some data in the neoadjuvant setting in patients who have node positive disease and doing tissue acquisition studies with serial biopsies. I think this may be a way for us to address some of these exciting questions that remain in a smaller type of trial with a shorter and follow-up. So less expensive, fewer patients enrolled, but still able to query a lot of these interesting questions.
Great. Well, that's everything I had for you, Dr. Hurvitz. Thank you so much for lending your time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take care.
Make sure to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcast. And if you listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com, and you can find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.